Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. As President Obama and Russian President Putin meet in Mexico and call for an immediate cessation of all violence in Syria, we go to Moscow for an update on press reports that Russia is sending naval reinforcements to Syria, possibly to evacuate its citizens. Dr. Pavel Felgenhauer, a Moscow-based independent defense analyst who writes for the only non-government-controlled newspaper, Novaya Gazeta, joins us to talk about what the two increasingly estranged leaders might be able to agree on. Then we'll look into the leadership shuffle in Saudi Arabia following the death of the Crown Prince and the ascension of the defense minister, Prince Salman, as the heir apparent. Toby Jones, the author of Desert Kingdom, How Oil and Water Forged Modern Saudi Arabia, joins us to discuss the inner workings of the feudal Al Saud family, who are pursuing an aggressive foreign policy against Syria and Iran while stifling democratic stirrings of the Arab Spring at home. Then finally, we'll examine the surprise showing of Syriza in the Greek elections with Richard Wolff, who is a professor emeritus of economics at the University of Amherst, Massachusetts, and author of Occupy the Economy, Challenging Capitalism. With over half of young Greeks and Spaniards unemployed, we will discuss the emergence of a new radical left in Europe, rebelling against the ruinous economic policies of a succession of conservative and socialist governments. Joining us now from Moscow is Dr. Pavel Felgenhauer, who is a Moscow-based defense analyst, columnist, and journalist. He previously served as senior research officer in the Soviet Academy of Sciences, and from 1994 to 2005, published a regular column on defense in the English-language local daily paper, The Moscow Times. And in 2006, after more than 6 years as an independent defense analyst, Felgenhauer joined the staff of Novaya Gazeta. Felgenhauer's regular commentary on Russia appears in many other local and international publications, and he joins us from Moscow. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dr. Pavel Felgenhauer.
Thank you.
And President Putin and President Obama are meeting in the Mexican resort in Los Cabos, the G20 summit, and there's an expectation, of course, that they will discuss Syria. We also learn that Russian naval ships are being sent. It's not an official release, but apparently there's two ships, the Caesar Kunikov and the Nikolai Felchenikov, on their way. They contain lots of tanks and marines, apparently. I suspect if this is true, the reports indicate that their main mission would be to protect Russian citizens in Syria.
Well, apparently these ships are still at anchor in Sevastopol.
I see.
And there are no Marines on board, and they didn't embark yet anywhere. And, well, it was actually, there have been reports appearing that Russia may deploy some troops abroad and maybe in Syria. Russia has a small naval facility there, and also there are Russian military advisors with the Syrian military serving there, continuing to serve there since the Cold War. But sending a military contingent, though there is a small one there already, reinforcing it, though that's possible. Though hardly tanks, I would expect to appear, because. Here in Moscow, they've been talking, military officials were saying that maybe there's going to be an evacuation of Russian military personnel from Syria. And so if that's the idea, then they'll have to go without tanks and not much troops on board, because these landing vessels would need to have their cargo bays empty to take on evacuees and Russian military equipment. But Syria is indeed a serious problem between Moscow and Washington today, as to some extent is Iran. There's many problems today between Moscow and Washington. Most likely, Presidents Obama and Putin will try to iron out some of them during their meeting.
So, Dr. Pavel Felgenhauer, what talk is there in Moscow of an evacuation of Russian citizens and military advisers? Is that a contingency plan, or are there serious expectations that this will have to take place?
Well, there has been some discussion about that. There was the deputy chief of the Russian Air Force said that, told journalists that if there's going to be an evacuation, the Russian Air Force could provide some cover to the Russian ships if they'll be sent there. Of course, the orders apparently have not been yet given to go. Russia military deployment in the area cannot be very strategically serious. I mean, this could be only a very small force. And their force cover also is problematic because there are no Russian air bases in the area. Russia doesn't have right now not a single aircraft carrier ready to go. And to reach the Middle East, the Russian planes would most likely have to use NATO airspace, fly over Turkey, and it's not clear that Turkey will allow. And they'll have to pass from Sevastopol through the Bosphorus. And again, if Turkey and NATO begin military operations, some military operations in Syria, it's not clear that Russian forces will be allowed to go through. In 1999, there was a plan to send a rather large Russian contingent of airborne troops to Kosovo when there was the conflict between Yugoslavia and NATO. But NATO countries did not allow Russian planes to fly through, so no large Russian contingent ever appeared in the theater. Right now, Russia does not have that much projection of force capability for that far off area, so I believe this is mostly posturing. Though there's a lot of posturing, the Russian foreign policy is today very much influenced by the internal situation in Russia, where anti-government protests in Moscow have continued for more than half a year already. And the Kremlin, President Putin, believe that these protests are inspired and possibly financed from abroad, from Washington. And this is not improving Russian-American relations or Russian-American cooperation on Syria or Iran or anywhere else.
Again, I'm speaking with Dr. Pavel Felgenhauer, a Moscow-based independent defense analyst, columnist, and journalist with Novaya Gazeta. But I imagine in this conversation that President Putin is having with President Obama now as we speak in Mexico, that those kind of discussions will come up. I don't think anybody in the White House would believe that the U.S. is involved in this, and I'm not even sure that Putin believes that the U.S. is really involved in stirring up Russian public opinion against himself. Is he in denial?
I believe that this is very much believed in the Kremlin. That's a serious problem right now in bilateral relations, and in and I say the Kremlin, President Putin, see a threat coming, and that makes Russian foreign policy, it influences Russian foreign policy and makes it more aggressive, I would say. But though Syria is a bit of a bridge too far, still the aggressiveness of Russian foreign policy, which many right now refer just to Mr. Putin returning to the Kremlin, and he's a kind of more harsh person than former President Medvedev, but also the internal political crisis in Russia is going to have a negative effect on foreign policy issues too.
But just to clarify this, Dr. Pavel Felgenhauer, I don't understand why a former KGB officer who has promoted a lot of KGB officers to his inner circle, and he seems to think and act like an intelligence officer, if there is evidence that the U.S. and other countries are manipulating Russian protests and domestic unrest against Putin, surely they would provide it, wouldn't they? They'd have the evidence. I mean, the SVR apparently is a fairly ubiquitous organization.
Oh, yes, there's evidence, of course. I mean, they say that, money found in the flat of Ksenia Sobchak must be kind of a high society girl. That's money most likely provided by the American State Department or something. I mean, yes, I mean, of course, the KGB has always been very, very effective in inventing and creating non-existent intelligence that would kind of support what the leaders of Russia always believed in, about American conspiracies, about Americans under the bed all the time. and conspiring from all sides to hinder Russia. So Mr. Putin's KGB background would even make you more susceptible to such conspiracy theories.
Well, but surely those 50,000-plus people that have been demonstrating in the streets of Moscow are not doing that because Washington tells them to do that.
Well, I mean, I'm not believing those stories, but they are a serious factor in Russian politics.
Right, but
that's a fact.
I understand, but I'm just wondering whether the Russian people believe it. I mean, apart from the people that are demonstrating,
some believe
they do.
Especially riot police. Actually, quite a number of polls taken with from riot policemen who are involved in. Dispersing some of these demonstrations, they believe that, yes, these are American mercenaries that they are beating up in the streets of Moscow.
So tell me, Dr. Pavel Felgin,
That's happening. It happened in many other countries, you know,
authoritarian.
Of course. It turns out that pro-democracy movements are American stooges.
The question, I guess, here, Dr. Pavel Felgenhauer, again, Moscow-based independent defense analyst, columnist, and journalist with Novaya Gazeta. The other question is, in terms of the support for Assad and in terms of the extent to which Assad and these Alawite death squads that he has, that his brother runs, that are killing people in terms of this, what's now being called a civil war, of course, there's a lot of moral outrage in the West, and I imagine that that will be the president's appeal to Putin in the G20 meeting that's taking place, that on humanitarian grounds, and perhaps he might even try to flatter Putin by saying that you're the only person in the world with sufficient influence over the Assads to get them to stop the killing. I understand that in Russia, the media basically reports pretty much what the Syrian media reports. Is that right?
Well, yes, more or less. And the Syrian situation is not, well, really much of a story in Russia. It's not on the first pages. And the fiasco of the Russian soccer team in Poland and the European Soccer Championship is much more of a real story than Syria is. So I believe appeals to Putin's consciousness at the summit will fall basically on deaf ears. They have been in the last months quite many times when I was asked by different interviewers by Al Jazeera and Westerners who are always saying, Russian attitude to Syria is changing. And I said, wait a minute, I don't see it changing. And I don't see any real change coming imminently now. There's no signs of it. Well, so I would believe that Putin is going to dig in his heels and repeat what was said before by the Russian foreign minister. And also you should understand that Russian influence over Syrian regime is not as really that serious. We cannot do much. Of course, we support them. We support them in the UN Security Council. There's some weapons arriving in Syria. And, of course, Russia is not allowing any arms embargo to be legalized by the UN. But that's more or less it. Yes, there's talk about sending a small contingent, military contingent to Syria, but no one is saying that we are going to actually fight there on anyone's side.
Sure.
And if a contingent appears, I would be very surprised if it would be more than 1,000 men. I believe it would be much less. So it's not any kind of serious force. It won't. It actually can't act independently. It can also only be part of some kind of international peacekeeping operation, or maybe be otherwise an auxiliary to the Syrian forces, but not really a serious military capability as during the Cold War when Russian military forces were deployed in Syria, they were deployed in Egypt, and they were there was a Russian fleet, a very serious Russian fleet in the Mediterranean, but that was the time of the Cold War. Right now, Russia doesn't have that capability. So our influence over Assad is a bit overestimated in the West. Though, of course, apparently we don't want to use that, what we even have, and that's also a reflection of what happened in a year ago in Libya. There's a pro-Syrian lobby in the arms trade community, in the military, military intelligence, that is clamoring that we should not abandon our Syrian friends. We should support them to the hilt. Up to now, the policy is more or less that. Though Russia has been making signals that if Assad falls, then it's okay, then we will kind of try and deal with who comes in his steps in his boots. But while he's there, we're going to more or less support the Assad regime. At least we'll not do anything to help undermine it.
Well, one would think that, Dr. Pavel Felgenhauer, that the foreign ministry people and the intelligence people would know sufficiently that the Syrian majority, the Sunni majority, is over 80%, and the Alawites are about 12 to 15%. The Christians have connections to the Russian Orthodox Church, but the long and the short of it is that after Assad, there will be a regime in there, a Sunni regime, that will be incredibly hostile to Russia. So I would think that some of the advice that Putin may be getting is that, you know, we've got to hedge our bets because we're too closely tied to Assad.
Well, there is a faction here that actually puts forward those arguments. One of the kind of more vocal people there is Mr. Mikhail Margilov, a Russian senator and chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, the upper house of the Russian Parliament, Federation Council, it's called in Russia. Yes, there is such an opinion, but it's right now not dominating actual politics. The foreign ministry, the military intelligence and political intelligence right now are more or less supporting the present line in backing the Syrian regime and hoping that it will sometimes survive there. Well, if not, we at least will say we did all we could.
So the church, do you think the Orthodox Church obviously has close ties to the Christians in Syria? And, of course, the Christians in Syria see what happened in next door in Iraq, where the Christians were basically slaughtered and driven out of the country. What kind of influence could they have in terms of any kind of mediation?
I don't think much. And the problem is actually that Russia does not have that much influence on any side of the conflict. We cannot actually demand that, say, the West change its position. I mean, we can demand, but it won't. We cannot really pressure much of the the Syrian opposition. And our leverage on the Assad regime is also highly limited. Assad has promised Russia to make reforms and kind of move towards the compromises. Then he didn't do that, and not much Russia could do.
Sure.
Abandon him right now, that's not considered an option still.
Well,
maybe some the Russian position may change. But right now, I don't see signs of it yet. So most likely, President Putin is going to be mostly stonewalling, though he may say some kind of conciliatory words that we want to compromise, we want all sides to stop fighting. Most likely so. Still, neither on Iran, neither on Syria right now, I don't see much flexibility. And this the Russian internal situation right now also does not very much allow that. A kind of very patriotic, maybe even jingoistic line is taken in the Russian press. That's very important to maybe try and split the Russian opposition to a democracy movement, which unites nationalist, leftist, and pro-Western liberals. And so an enemy at the gate, American conspiracy, and kind of opposing the Western America on Syria or Iran may be seen as a point to rally the opposition, at least parts of the opposition, at least the nationalists, around Putin and split the opposition movement. So again, I don't see much right now for Putin, the Kremlin, to win in changing position on Syria. And so change of position is highly unlikely.
Well, just in closing, Dr. Pavel Felgenhauer, the U.S. and Russia appear to be cooperating down in the south in the border of Afghanistan. The U.S. has basically given up negotiating with Pakistan, who are demanding extra money for shipping supplies into NATO and America's forces in Afghanistan, who are withdrawing in 2014. It looks as though they've made a deal to withdraw via the former Russian republics in the south. It's a long land route and rail route. Russia's objected to having lethal equipment, but apparently they've agreed to the withdrawal of all this equipment, a huge amount of equipment. What do you know about that? Is that realpolitik? Is that the fact that Russia doesn't want the Taliban to come back in Afghanistan and are willing to cooperate?
Well, the Taliban taking over Afghanistan, say, as it took over 90% of Afghanistan in the year 2000, would be an obvious threat to Russian interests in Central Asia. Though on the other side, such a threat would unite the authoritarian dictators of Central Asian republics to seek Russian help, and they would be much more easier to control. So there's still geopolitical kind of rivalry. So there is some cooperation, but there's also a lot of both sides actually don't like each other and suspect each other.
Well,
it's not a very good cooperation, but still there is at least some.
Well, does that mean, though, that we're already seeing a kind of return to Cold War rhetoric in the back and forth between Secretary of State Hillary Clinton and Putin? And you mentioned Putin's paranoid and thinks that the U.S. is behind the protests against his regime and against United Russia in Russia. Do you see a return to the Cold War in any kind of... It's starting to happen rhetorically. I'm wondering whether it could get worse.
Yes, it could get worse, there could be serious conflicts. There could be even wars like the one in what happened in August 2008 when Russian forces invaded Georgia. I don't see any real possibility of bilateral relations really getting much better before there's a change of regime in Moscow. Well, maybe there'll be also a change of regime in Washington. There's elections coming up. And most likely afterwards somewhere there could be a move to really find a quid pro quo and a much better basic foundation for better relations.
Well, it won't happen under Romney. Romney's already said that Russia is America's number one geopolitical foe.
Traditionally, actually, Russian professional diplomats and intelligence people and military prefer Republicans. They don't like Democrats. They believe that they are kind of posturing about human rights, and the realpolitik Republicans have always been a better bargaining team for Russia traditionally. All major Russian-American breakthroughs happened under Republican administrations. The biggest one, of course, under Richard Nixon, actually, of all people.
Well, and under Ronald Reagan, too. So,
yes.
Question...
And George Bush, the elder.
Right. No, there's no question that the historical record is very clear on that. Well, I thank you so much for joining us from Moscow, Dr. Pavel Felgenhauer.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Dr. Pavel Felgenhauer, who's a Moscow-based defense analyst, columnist, and journalist. He previously served as senior research officer in the Soviet Academy of Sciences, and from 1994 to 2005, he published a regular column on defense in the English-language local daily, the Moscow Times. And in 2006, after more than 6 years as an independent defense analyst, Felgenhauer joined the staff of Novaya Gazeta. Felgenhauer's regular commentary on Russia appears in many other local and international publications, and he joined us from Moscow. And we're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking about the leadership shuffles in Saudi Arabia with the deaths of crown princes. Case, honey,
us back in the USSR. Well, the delivery girl's really not me.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Toby Jones, Professor of History at Rutgers University and author of Desert Kingdom, How Oil and Water Forged Modern Saudi Arabia. From 2008 to 2009, he was a fellow at Princeton University's Oil, Energy and Middle East Project. And from 2004 to early 2006, he worked as the principal analyst of the Persian Gulf for the International Crisis Group, where he wrote about political reform and sectarianism. Welcome to Background Briefing, Toby Jones.
Thanks for having me on.
And the death of the Saudi Interior Minister and Crown Prince Nayef is the second death of an heir apparent in the last 9 months. This is obviously the rule of octogenarians with the king, Abdullah, who is 88 years old. Nayef was, I think, I don't know how old he was, but his successor now, Prince Salman, the defense minister, is 76 years old. There's talk of a new generation, but not much evidence that the new generation is emerging.
No, it seems as though the passing of the torch to the grandchildren of the original founder, the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia, and remember the kingdom was founded in 1932, the third generation of leadership, if you will, still seems some point off in the distance. The brothers and the half-brothers will pass power amongst themselves until they agree by consensus to move on to the next generation. But it's hard to know what the internal thinking of all that is or what the moment might be that determines when that or how that happens.
Well, the brothers are all, and Salman and Nayef are brothers, are called the Sederis, named after the favorite wife of Abdulaziz, right?
Well, Salman and Nayef are members of the Sederi branch of the family. Abdullah is not.
Right.
And there's a widespread belief that the Sederis will pass power amongst themselves. But we have to remember something basic about the Ilfod and the way power works. And they've had hiccups before in the past. There have been intra-family squabbles. There have been competitions for power. And they've learned some of the lessons from all of that in the 1950s and the 1960s. And one thing that they are is they understand that they're in the business of self-preservation, right? So they can't be necessarily ideological amongst themselves. Saudi Arabia is not an absolute monarchy. They consult amongst one another. They will do what's in the best interest of the family and in protecting their very privileged position atop the political order. I don't think they'll risk that. Now, there's the possibility of some rogue element within the family attempting a coup, but it's hard to imagine what quarter that would come from.
So the youngest of the Sederis, right, he's the intelligence, heads up foreign intelligence, Mukrin. I mean, so not, you just said that the Sederis' brother, Prince Salman, who's the defense minister, who's now the heir apparent, he could appoint one of his brothers, right? And then Abdullah's doesn't have a succession, right?
Right. Well, certainly Abdullah will not name the next move will be Salman's successor, the deputy prime minister, right. Which will most likely be one of his brothers or half brothers.
Sure.
Abdullah will not seek to outflank his brothers and appoint one of his own children or somebody else's child, say a child of King Faisal, who was killed in 1975, for example, Turki al-Faisal or one of the other prominent of Faisals. He won't outmaneuver his brother, so that would risk turmoil within the family. And as I suggested, they're interested in self-preservation. I mean, there's a tremendous amount of privilege that's at stake. Set aside the question of power, and this is a place that almost literally generates cash hand over fist, right? So risking that is too much for all of them to bear. They're in the interest of protecting their fortune.
Well, therein lies the extraordinary irony in context of the Arab Spring, the notion that this is a sort of feudal, absolute monarchy, no parliament, no even pretense of anything, but a parliament who basically the oil revenues are their private piggy banks.
Oh, there's no doubt about it. There's a distinction that gets made analytically amongst observers and those who purport to do so and purport to sort of bring some analytical rigor to bear. But there's a distinction between the republican or presidential systems, such as those that we saw in Egypt and Syria and Libya, compared to the monarchical systems, you know, the monarchies in Saudi Arabia, the other oil kingdoms, or emirates. And in fact, in practice, they're very similar. I mean, these are close cousins, right? They're deeply autocratic. Power is shared by a very small group of people. What distinguishes Saudi Arabia from Syria and Egypt is not the nature of the political system. It's the vast wealth that the El Saud have in reserve, and they have the ability to tap into. And of course, that's because they sit on more oil than anybody else in the world.
And they've been starting to use that wealth. They've normally had a pretty dormant foreign policy. But now, under Abdullah, they've become quite active in opposing Iran. They've invaded Bahrain and basically taken it over. And they're, along with the Qataris, are funding the Syrian opposition. The extent to which they're doing that is not entirely clear. But at least they're staking their ground, which they've never done before.
But they've been active in the past. In the 1960s, they were involved in Yemen's civil war.
Oh, that's true, yes.
They have sent the National Guard into Bahrain in the 1990s. You know, they fought a proxy war with the Egyptians. They've aspired to political primacy in the Middle East. They funded Saddam Hussein's war machine against Iran. You're right. I mean, historically, this is not an activist regime when it comes to foreign policy. But over the last 18 months or so, they've certainly flexed their muscles. You rightly noted, along with the Qataris. The Saudis, it seems to me, are much more clearly committed to a balance of power political game, in that they see Iran as their principal rival in the region. They've taken steps to preserve the status quo in the region as much as possible. Bahrain, Yemen, they didn't mind tossing Gaddafi out of power because he's kind of far removed. But even in Syria, where they seem to support the forces of revolution, in fact, I think the more appropriate way to understand their actions there is that they want to win Syria from Iran rather than, you know, see any kind of principled or ideological or democratic outcome. They simply want to establish their own hegemony in the Levant, and that's one way to do so.
Again, I speak with Toby Jones, professor of history at Rutgers University and author of Desert Kingdom, How Oil and Water Forged Modern Saudi Arabia. So, what about internal dissent then? Obviously, this is a country with a young majority and no political reform. Everybody said that Nayef was a conservative and a reactionary, and that the new prince, Salman, the defense minister, is a little more liberal. I don't imagine that that's going to amount to anything. They seem to be pretty absolutely rigid about maintaining this absolute monarchy. They do have a Shia majority in the oil-rich part of the country, close on the Persian Gulf. So how much is their foreign policy being used as a distraction, and how threatened are they by internal dissent?
Well, I think a year ago, when we were first sort of taking stock of the Saudi Arabia's anxiety about the Arab Spring and the uprisings across the region and what it might mean, I think they were deeply anxious about it. I think they sensed that there was a democratic wave, that there was certainly the potential for a demonstration effect. And their intervention in Bahrain was not only an expression of their anxiety about Shiite empowerment, it was also an anxiety that, you know, if there could be regime change in the Gulf, then Bahrain could become ground zero for a regional phenomenon, a regional trend. So they were anxious about it. A year on, we haven't seen mass mobilization in Saudi Arabia, although there have been expressions of dissent. I think the Saudis are a little bit more confident, even if they know that underneath the surface there are deep sentiments of anxiety and frustration. I mean, keep in mind that although Saudi Arabia has staggering wealth, a massive influx of petrodollars, that over 20% of its population lives beneath its own poverty line, those statistics determined by Saudi Ministry of Information, and it has somewhere between 20 and 30% unemployment. So there are large sectors of the Saudi population that are disillusioned with the status quo, and it would certainly like to see some sort of political or economic or political economic change. So then the Saudis are aware of that. Nayef's death whatever label we attribute to it, whether he's conservative or reactionary or Islamist or something else, signals more than anything to Saudi citizens the end of an era of policing. As he was Saudi Arabia's chief cop, controlled all the domestic intelligence and police services, and he was a reactionary when it came to his belief that the police were a blunt instrument to impose political and moral order. I think what Saudis hope is that Salman and whoever succeeds Naif at the Interior Ministry will mean a softer approach to domestic politics, which may result in the creation of more space for social and political activism. You're right, though, that we should be skeptical about that.
I thank you so much for joining us here today, Toby Jones.
Right.
Again, I've been speaking with Toby Jones, professor of history at Rutgers University and author of Desert Kingdom, How Oil and Water Forged Modern Saudi Arabia. We're going to take a brief station break and be back talking about the emergence of a new radical left in Europe.
Then they fight you. Then you win.
I heard him say the revolution won't be televised. Al Jazeera proved him wrong. Twitter has him paralyzed. 80 million strong and ain't no longer gonna be terrorized. Organized, mobilized, vocalized. On the side of truth, the Madunya's living proof that it's a matter of time for the chickens home to roost. Boy, Azizi lit the hoof. And it slowly ignited the fire within every people to fight it. From Tunis to Khan Yunis, the new moon shines bright as the man's.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Richard Wolff, who is a professor emeritus of economics at the University of Massachusetts Amherst and is currently a visiting professor in the graduate program of international affairs at the New School University in New York City. Richard Wolff is the author of the new book, Occupy the Economy, Challenging Capitalism. Welcome to Background Briefing, Richard Wolff.
Thank you very much, Ian.
And it looks as though capitalism and cronyism and corruption were challenged in the elections yesterday in Greece. Syriza came out of nowhere in the last elections, and now in this current one on Sunday, they received 27% of the vote. I spoke with a young Greek-American artist who was at a party for Syriza, and she voted for Syriza. And it was very poignant talking to her because it's really generational. This is about the youth unemployment of 60%, and it's over 50% in Spain. And these young people are saying, why should our futures be stolen? Why should we be mortgaged to a bunch of crooked politicians who ruined our economies?
Yes, I think the line of development in politics in Europe right now is absolutely wonderful and astonishing in ways that few of us could have foreseen. Yesterday there were elections in Greece, as you say. There were similarly elections completing the election cycle in France and handing the Socialist Party in France the most complete control of the presidency, the upper and lower houses of the parliament that they've probably ever seen, in a election clearly voting no on the austerity programs of their predecessor Sarkozy. And in Greece, Syriza is basically a voice well to the left of the French Socialist Party that is also saying, as you put it, that the whole capitalist system is one that they are simply not willing to tolerate. Not the crisis it delivered to them 5 years ago, not the bailouts of big corporations and banks that bypassed most Greek citizens, and now for sure not the austerity in which they're being asked to pay the cost of a bailout broken system that didn't help them in the first place. It's really too much, and you're seeing the political result.
So what are we seeing here, Richard Wolff? Are we seeing a resurgence of the radical left, as some have described, or are we seeing a last-ditch attempt to save social democracy?
Well, I think it's both. I think you're seeing in Syriza and the also important position played by the Greek Communist Party, which Western media refused to cover but is an important part of Greek politics. You see in their strength, voting strength, membership strength, political action strength, a resurgence of the left and also a new surge of the left, drawing on the new generation of people, but drawing on a changed situation. Capitalism has been a disaster for 5 years. It is not delivering the goods. It's mostly, for most people, delivering one bad after another. And the tolerability and the acceptance and the sense that there's no real alternative, all of those are fading. It should be noted that even though the New Democracy Party won, that the old Greek politics, in which the New Democracy and the Socialist Party kind of played musical chairs with running Greek society, that's over. Those two parties together cannot even get half the vote combined, let alone the kinds of votes they used to have. And most of the rest of the space has been taken up by a left that is very critical not only of the crisis, but of a system that keeps functioning in this unacceptable way.
Now, one of the great ironies here is that, of course, that Greece was the first battleground in the beginning of the Cold War, the post-World War II era, where Truman intervened and the communists looked like they might take over the country. What followed that, along with the Marshall Plan, was the building of social democracies in Europe and in Japan, who have benefits for their citizens that we in the United States don't have, like health care, et cetera, which is now under threat from the Supreme Court. It's always struck me as an extraordinary irony that the U.S. exported social democracy and laid the foundations for these prosperous countries today like Germany, Italy, Spain. Not that, I mean, they're in trouble now, but they've survived for some time under social democracy. France, where the citizens have tremendous benefits that we in the United States can only dream of, and what little benefits we have here in the United States in terms of pensions and with Social Security and medical help through Medicare, they're under threat. So what seems to be happening now is that these arrangements are over, the Cold War construct is over, and that the social safety nets are being deliberately eviscerated. Because, in other words, the Ryan plan that we have here in the United States to rip up what's left of our social safety net is alive and well in Europe as well.
Yes, I think you're seeing exactly that. You're seeing that large corporations in their typical capitalist competition, say between the United States and Europe, found over the last 25 years that they could make a lot more money, for example, by closing their operations in the United States and in parts of Europe and in moving them to China or to India or to other low-wage areas, and keeping the difference in the value of what they produced and the low wages they paid in the form of a record level of profits. And we're now seeing, in a sense, the fallout, the consequences. The best way to break social democracy, the best way to break the union movement in the United States, for that matter, was to move production away, leave the workers here with nothing, threaten every union that exists that if they don't cave in to what the employer wants, the employer will move production to where it's even more profitable in the third world, etc., etc. And you're now seeing the consequences of that. But the answer to that has always been and is today whether the mass of people, the majority, permit that kind of behavior. Do you permit a corporation to get up and leave and go to another place to make more profits with all the social consequences, destructive ones, left behind, for which these companies have no responsibility, no obligation? If you do, then you will experience the kind of economic long-term decline that now confronts Europe, and that is so obvious in places like Spain and Portugal and Ireland and Hungary and, of course, Greece. And I think what's being understood, it's taken 4 or 5 years of this crisis, but what's being understood is that the whole quality of job and work life and community is in play now, and that if the current directions and leaderships are left alone, then the kind of suffering of the Greek people will be replicated in Spain and countless other countries, by the way, not exempting the United States, because it's under the exact same pressures. So I think, in a sense, even people who can't say the words kind of understand that something of the nature of an ancient Greek drama is being played out again in that part of the world.
But what explains the fact that the Germans have the most successful export economy in the world? And again, going back to the Marshall Plan, they, for example, half of the boards of directors of German companies are members of unions. So you have a very exemplary kind of social democracy there. But what the Germans don't seem to appreciate is that the euro has helped their export markets enormously. The Greeks bought Mercedes and BMWs, as did the Spaniards and the Portuguese and everybody else around the world. So what explains the idea that the German elite would want to shred the social contracts in the southern tier, in the Catholic parts of Europe, and at the same time diminish their export markets?
Well, it's very interesting. The first thing about Germany, and I'm very glad you picked it, has to do with driving home the point. American conservatives, never one to pay too terribly close attention to the facts, like to suggest that Europe is now catching up with the wisdom of the United States in shredding the safety net, because they must. I always like to point out that the most powerful economy in Europe, the German, is not only not shredding the safety net, which was much larger there than it has been almost anywhere else, but in many ways is preserving it, but that at the same time, that is not a bad strategy for weathering a crisis. It's actually an excellent one. Germany is an example of a society that is doing better than the United States, markedly better, through this crisis, even though they do, in fact, maintain a much more generous safety net for the mass of their people than we do. But to answer the question why the Germans have done so well, I think the unspoken part of that story that people have to recognize, and I am always a little mystified why they don't, is the fact that probably the Germans owe this to communism. And let me explain. Germany has been recently unified. It was a separated country between East and West for most of the post-war period. During that time, until the reunification in the 1990s, the East Germans became the most successful industrialization story of the entire Eastern Europe. Over the 40 or 50 years since the end of World War II, East Germany's people became a highly skilled, highly disciplined industrial working class, one of the most productive, most skilled, most disciplined probably in the world. But they were paid a much lower wage level than their counterparts in Western Germany for all kinds of historical reasons. Eastern Germany was always a relatively poorer part of Germany than the West. When unification happened, basically the dissolution of East Germany delivered into the hands of employers in Western Germany an unbelievable gift, a huge group of highly skilled, highly disciplined industrial workers who spoke the same language. No one else has had this gift. The United States gets people from Latin America, for example, but they do not speak English. They are not highly educated. They are not highly skilled. They are poor. The Japanese get all kinds of immigrants from East Asia. It's a very similar story. The Germans, unlike any other country in Europe, for that matter, was the beneficiary of a huge trained industrial work class whose wages were several times lower than the average in Western Germany. They have been slowly integrated into West German capitalism, sometimes by investments being made in what was before East Germany, but in many cases, people moving through family connections with the same culture and language into Western Germany, enabling the capitalists there to get workers on the cheap, and to be able, therefore, to keep their prices relatively lower, not rising as fast as they did everywhere else in Europe. And so the unified euro, the unified common market, presented the Germans with a huge increase in their market at the same time that they got a huge gift of inexpensive, highly trained, skilled workers. Once you understand that combination and that it was not shared by any other European country, you can see why the Germans were able to do well. They like to tell us it has to do with German ingenuity or brilliant political leadership, but that's really silly. They got something out of the breakdown of Eastern Europe that was better for them than anything comparable won by anybody they were competing with. And the results are what you see.
And, of course, Angela Merkel herself comes from the East.
Absolutely. Couldn't be a better person to literally symbolize the whole integration of the East to the advantage of German capitalism in its competitions everywhere else. But the danger for Germany, if I can say a word about it, is that you are now galvanizing all of Southern Europe and an increasing portion of Eastern Europe as well into enemies of Germany. Seeing what the Germans have done is to take advantage of the unification of Europe at the expense of all the other countries that unified with Europe, keeping the game going by taking their monstrous profits and lending them to the Spanish and the Italians and the Greeks to keep the kind of the thing going, a little bit like American corporations lent so much money to their own workers over the last 40 years, and the bubble eventually burst to everyone's dismay. I think the Germans are making a political grotesque miscalculation in underestimating the kind of opposition building to them in that unified Europe, which may not survive as a unity because of it.
So it's an interesting irony, isn't it, Richard Wolff, that you just mentioned that the communists helped the German capitalists and the whole birth of social democracy in Europe, which we don't have in there. Our elite denied us social democracy here in the United States, but exported it during the Marshall Plan as a way to stop the communists taking over Europe. I find it deeply ironic. But when I spoke with the young Syriza voter on Sunday, who was at a party for the Syriza voters, they were basically talking about their future being stolen and how they wanted some justice and they wanted nothing to do with the crooks that got the country into this mess, and the idea that the lenders in the big banks in Germany and elsewhere have never been punished and the borrowers were irresponsible, crooked Greek politicians, and then they're all stuck with the bill. They may be anti-capitalists, but she didn't sound like a communist. So what kind of political arrangement is going to emerge with the new left in Greece and perhaps in Spain and other countries in response to what's happening?
Well, I think that's a very big question, and I think time will tell. I think we're at the early stages. It has taken Europeans 3-4 years of being in what we might call shock and awe, watching the safety net they thought was secure prove to be insecure, watching a capitalism that celebrated its ability to provide social welfare, removing or trying to remove the social welfare. It's taken them a time to overcome the notion, as Margaret Thatcher liked to say, that there is no alternative to capitalism, and come to the realization that given what capitalism's offering them, capitalism itself is no longer an acceptable alternative, and that they will have to look for others. But you're talking about a generation that has been, if not depoliticized, very badly turned off by the conventional politics. We should remember that over the last 2 years, in 2010 and 11, basically, the austerity in a place like Greece was imposed by a government of a socialist party, probably set back the cause of socialism in Greece, as the similar things are happening in other countries, for generations to come, by having turned on the working class they're supposed to represent. And I think you're seeing a dissolution of conventional ideas in politics. And so we're at that early stage where a clear notion of what the alternative is, sort of in the way that in the earlier part of the late part of the 19th and early part of the 20th century, communists had a fairly good idea, and even socialists did, that they wanted public ownership instead of private, that they wanted economic planning instead of markets. Those kinds of clear demarcations, those have dissolved along with all of the claims and pretenses of modern capitalism, and you're in a period of searching and looking for where to go on the part of a people who largely withdrew from intense political participation because they didn't think they needed to. They didn't think their welfare depended on it. They took for granted what had been achieved. All of that is dissolving now, and that's what makes the Syriza vote so interesting, that in their first kind of massive breaking away from conventional politics, the overwhelming majority of people willing to break away from the old conventions are moving sharply to the left. And that is a very important sign, just as, in a different way, that's true in France as well. They're going to give their old socialist party what I believe is one more chance. If they do not deliver in a systematic way on the promises that François Hollande and the others in France made, then to their left is the French equivalent of Syriza, and that is the Front de Gauche, the left front, which didn't do so badly at all in this latest election, much better than had been predicted as little as 6 months ago. And I think you see waiting in the wings a further sign of the disaffection of huge portions, particularly of younger people, which has enormous implications into the future, moving to the left out of a sheer unwillingness to continue to accept the benefits and losses that capitalism dishes out.
Well, just in closing though, Richard Wolff, it's clear that capitalism is failing, but it's also clear that communism, at least of what we saw in the Soviet Union and People's Republic of China, have failed. You have gangster capitalism in Russia, and you have a kind of cruel crony capitalism in China. Where you're not suggesting that the communists are coming back.
No, I'm not. I think that whatever the reality is, and it may well be as you describe it, the image in most Western and even most third world countries of what is going on in places like Russia and China, even before the end of the USSR, does make that not the model that people are going to look to, not the model that people are going to follow. It's not that the notions of social ownership of means of production and planning are to be rejected. I don't think that's going to happen. I think you're going to see more and more of that. Indeed, the capitalist countries themselves are moving in that direction. But I think you're quite right. That's going to have to be a new and different image of what the alternative to modern capitalism is. And I think I can tell you what that will be from the signs already developing. And that will be a focus on a new alternative that doesn't look to what the government is going to do or not do, not to how the government owns things or how the government plans things. That the new focus will be at the micro level, the level of the enterprise itself. And the demand is going to be to end the old, undemocratic, capitalist organization of production. No more handful of major shareholders selecting a board of directors who makes all the decisions. What to buy, what to produce, how to produce, where to produce, what to do with the profits. That all has to change. That those decisions have to be made collectively and democratically, not only by the workers in each enterprise, but in consultation and co-direction, if you like, with the residents in the communities interacting with those enterprises. The democratization of work and enterprise is, I believe, going to be the defining focus that distinguishes 21st century socialism from its predecessors over the last 100 years.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Richard Wolff.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
Again, I've been speaking with Richard Wolff, who is a professor emeritus of economics at the University of Massachusetts Amherst and is currently a visiting professor in the Graduate Program for International Affairs at the New School University in New York City. He's the author of the new book, Occupy the Economy, Challenging Capitalism.
And again, I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Chris Scheid. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another background briefing. Bye for now. And they don't talk about the home of the brave and the land here under free, one time, one time in America. A lady dressed in white with a man she loved.